here on 90.1.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston, with translators at 89.5 FM K208DG Galveston and 91.9 FM K220KC Huntsville. Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica radio station.
Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and it's found only on Houston's community station, listener-sponsored KPFT. I am Hank Rubicek, producer and tonight's host, and every week, with the help from the best team on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on journeys through windows of their soul. It's our winter drive tonight. Yeah, I know. Again? Well, stay with me for a moment. I want you to imagine a world without stories about jubilation, tragedy, loss, embarrassing moments, that perfect meal, choosing a puppy, your first child, first kiss, falling in love over and over again. So What's Your Story started it all in the world of storytelling in Houston. And this award-winning show has brought over 500 storytellers into your homes and hearts since 2008. We were off the air for a while and you beckoned us back, and we plan to keep it going for the rest of our lives with the rest of the innovative programmers on this special station, KPFT. Pacifica, born of the peace movement in 1948, because we are corporate free, we need your help, and so as a result, we really want you to give us a call at 713-526-5738, jam KPFT, or by going to www.kpft.org/donations. Tell us how you want to pay, and then scroll to So What's Your Story as a show that you want to support. You're going to be listening to us during drive time, so for God's sakes, don't do any of that while you're driving. It can wait. Just stay safe. A number of summers ago, I went into a Starbucks in the morning. It was really early. There wasn't anybody there. The barristers were putting on their shirts, and there wasn't anybody looking at their PCs or on the phones. And I placed an order. I said, I want a tall, non-fat vanilla latte. And I was asked, what's your name? And I said, well, why? I'm the only one here. The young man said, well, it's because of what we do. I said, okay, Mick Jagger. Looked at me and he said, sir, we just need your first name. I said, okay, Mick. A few moments later, young lady calls my name out, Mick. I realized that Mick Jagger was someone he never heard of before. A couple of hours later, I'm coming out of the dentist's office and I had to make an appointment for 6 months down the road. The office manager said, Dr. Rubicek, it looks like 6 months from this day will be December 7th. Will that work for you? And I break out into my FDR imitation. Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. She looked at me, and said, "Did you just make that up?" Well, I realized what little people knew. Now, they happen to be millennials, all right? And I'm not bashing millennials. I love them. I've taught college for over 40 years. They're my customers. Besides, there are lots of people beyond millennial age who don't know much about the world in which we live. But things have changed. So with the help of my guest, one of the best tellers around and nicest guys you'll want to know, we're going to blend humor with a bit of actuality, for lack of a better word, by dispensing a few stories similar to the Mick Jagger experience I shared a moment ago. My guest has been on before, and when you hear him tell a story, you'll know why he's back. Dan Carter is a professor emeritus at Penn State, having served 22 years as director of the School of Theater and artistic director of Pennsylvania Center Stage. Before that appointment, he was associate dean for production of the School of Theater at Florida State and chair of the Department of Theater at Illinois State, where he also served as producing director of Illinois Shakespeare Festival. Before entering the world of university administration, Dan worked as an actor, director, stage manager, and fight director. He studied at San Francisco's American Conservatory Theater, apprenticed right here at the Alley Theater in Houston, and made his professional debut in theater company at Boston's Richard III, starring Al Pacino. He was also in Smokey and the Bandit 2, Cannonball Run, and Sharky's Machine. He received the Illinois State University Alumni Achievement Award in 1999 and is a member of the Rock Valley College Hall of Fame. This is just a glimpse of Dan, and I don't really do him much justice here. So check out his comprehensive bio on our Facebook page. Dan, how are you? Welcome back. I might as well let everybody know that I screwed up our previous recording. So we're doing it again. You've got to be exhausted. But I'm an idiot. I'm a techno idiot. And, you know, what can I tell you? But,
you know, Hank, they didn't need to know that. It's great.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm going to let them know because, you know what? This is a show about millennials. They might as well need to know that old people like me can't do you know what anyway.
Now, what does this button do?
What does this button do? Right. Now, Dan, I mentioned the FDR speech. It's a rhetorical masterpiece that moved the nation and changed the world. The cultural awareness is another field of frustration, and your first story centers around it. Tell us that story.
We all have gaps in our education, and of course, there's different kinds of knowledge. Some is arcane, primarily for specialists and enthusiasts. General knowledge is great for Jeopardy, Trivial Pursuit, or a bar bet, but as long as you've got access to your smartphone, these are the kinds of things that are literally at your fingertips. People rightly say, why do I need to know that when I can look it up? And things change. De Tocqueville said, if you want to know about America, you have to understand baseball. And that was once true, but not today. Not just because baseball, I'm sad to say, is no longer America's pastime, but because America has changed. Some information is tribal knowledge. That is, it links us to or helps us bond quickly with others. For example, I understand that not everyone can come up with the names John, Paul, George, and Ringo, but if you're my age and you can't, we probably don't have much in common. But a core of common knowledge is one of the things that binds us together as a society, a true melting pot where E pluribus unum is not an empty slogan, but out of the many, we truly become one. That's a growing concern. A friend who taught popular culture said students had three historical frames of reference: color, black and white, and pre-TV. That was 30 years ago she said that, so she might amend it now to include post-TV, the smartphone era. My favorite story to illustrate this is when a Penn State colleague reached out to a history teacher for an interdisciplinary project. He went to this professor's office, and as the meeting began, the professor's phone rang, so Bob only heard one side of the conversation, which went like this: yes, it's a student, Bob. I'll be with you in just a minute. Yes, World War II. The Germans and the Japanese. We did. I understand that today's college students are as far removed from the Vietnam War as I was from World War I. And World War I to them is the same as the Civil War to me. Still, these are part of the fabric of the country. And while we can't be slaves to the past, we need to understand where we came from, if for no other reason to stand up to all those people who state with authority what is and is not American. World War II provides a number of humorous anecdotes about the consequences a lack of knowledge of popular culture can have. During the Battle of the Bulge, there was fear of infiltration by German soldiers, some of whom had lived in the U.S. and spoke perfectly good American English. Worried that passwords had been compromised, MPs would often augment them, challenging even those who knew the passwords with additional questions such as, who plays center field for the Yankees? What's Mickey Mouse's girlfriend's name? What's a Texas Leaguer? Who's married to Betty Grable? Sometimes this didn't play out so well. Told to be on the lookout for a German disguised as a one-star general, an MP challenged General Bruce Clark and put him in shackles for a half hour because the general identified the Chicago Cubs as an American League team. The very next day, General Omar Bradley was detained when he rightly identified the capital of Illinois as Springfield. The MP was certain it was Chicago. One trick MPs used was challenging soldiers by asking them to recite the second verse of the Star-Spangled Banner. Anyone who could was immediately taken into custody under the assumption that they had learned it in spy school because few Americans know more than the first verse. So, to flip an Alexander Popeism, a little too much knowledge can also be a dangerous thing.
I suppose. Yeah, too much knowledge, huh? I don't think we have to worry about that in today's world. I wanted to say millennials are smart. I have to say this. They are socially progressive and they're digitally savvy. And we older folks, we seniors, are challenged by anything with the word Apple, Instagram, and download, not to mention problems with manual dexterity, visual impairment, and just simply not getting it. But according to Rolling Stone, there are a few cultural artifacts that leave younger folks a little clueless. In no particular order, the short list includes answering machines, Sybil Shepherd, Dabney Coleman, Clyde Drexler, dial-up modem, Ross Perot, Hunger Strike, Marky Mark, Koosh Balls, Mikhail Gorbachev, Getting Film Developed, and Rod Serling. My limited research shows that most millennials haven't seen Casablanca, The Godfather, The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, The Graduate, Citizen Kane, and a lot more. Now, there are always exceptions, I know, but I guess it's a question of perceived relevance. There was a trailer about a special about Abraham Lincoln, the one that's actually on the History Channel now. It was on a TV at a bar I frequent. And I noticed a young man seated a few stools away. He was shaking his head, seemingly in disapproval when he was seeing this ad. Mildly impaired, I guess, by a couple of single malts, I asked him the question, tell me something, in what years were the Civil War fought? He was taken back by my chutzpah, but politely answered, a long time ago. It was before my time, he continued, and I assured him, it was before mine, too. Now, Dan, I hope that your students saw Smokey and the Bandit or at least lied about seeing it.
Some of them did. I don't know that the ones more recently have, but in the 90s and the 80s they had. It was made in 1980 when Burt was the number one box office star in the world. And it was for a short time the largest grossing film in history. Until I think Close Encounters bumped it. Yeah. One student of mine, when he realized it was me, was kind of flabbergasted. He said, my friends and I, when we were teenagers, quoted that line of yours all the time. It wouldn't have made their mothers happy, I'm sure. And it's not a line I can repeat on radio, but they can look it up.
they can figure it out. Yeah, I had a student named Dorothy once, and I said, Dorothy, She thought I was out of my mind. She had no idea that I was imitating the Wicked Witch of the West, right? Well, let's move to your next story because it's a natural extension of the one you just told. Share it with us.
About a year before he went off the air, Johnny Carson included as one of his guests, Lieutenant General Thomas W. Kelly, who conducted press briefings during the Gulf War and became the face of reemerging American pride in the undisputed superiority of our military might, which had been damaged during the Vietnam War, but was reestablished during Desert Storm. He spoke passionately and eloquently, but then said something very strange. Quote, "I could never have served in any other military because the United States has the only military that has never turned its weapons on its own citizens." And I thought, huh? And Johnny nodded, and the audience applauded, and nobody said, say what? The general was either ignorant of significant pieces of our history or simply brazen enough to think he could get away with saying whatever he wanted. Now, in refuting General Kelly's assertion, I'm not going to include Sand Creek, Wounded Knee, or any other atrocities perpetrated against Native Americans, because most of those occurred before 1924 when federal law enfranchised all Native Americans born in the U.S. So the general would have been technically correct that those people weren't citizens. On the other hand, almost two-thirds of the Japanese interned during World War II were U.S. citizens, and it was the military that put them there and kept them there. But aside from these, the regular army has taken the field against U.S. citizens numerous times, beginning as early as 1794, when President Washington led troops into western Pennsylvania to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion. The army was called in again to quell the 1863 New York City draft riots. And of course, there was the bloodiest of all U.S. conflicts, the Civil War. General Kelly apparently never spoke with anyone from Georgia. When Rutherford B. Hayes used federal troops to end the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, he caused such a bipartisan furor that Congress passed a law prohibiting the army being used to address domestic issues. Despite that, over the years, military use to quell civil unrest has spanned political and social divides. President Eisenhower sent the 101st Airborne to Little Rock to enforce the desegregation of public schools in 1957. And LBJ mobilized the National Guard in Alabama following violence on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965. The National Guard has frequently been used, including the Colorado Labor Wars of 1903 and 04, and again 10 years later, once again confronting miners. They were called out to quell riots in Detroit and Newark in 1967, and during the Los Angeles riots following the verdict in the Rodney King case in 1992. And of course, the Kent State Massacre in 1970. But the incident I want to focus on happened in 1932, about 2 months before General Kelly was born, the last cavalry charge on U.S. soil, the target of which was the so-called Bonus Army, which was comprised of World War I veterans. The story includes a who's who of 20th century American politics, including presidents Coolidge and Hoover, General MacArthur, then majors Patton and Eisenhower, and peripherally FDR and Harry Truman, as well as DC socialite Evelyn Walsh McLean, owner of the Hope Diamond. That same 1924 Congress that passed the Indian Citizenship Act approved a bonus for World War I veterans, which President Coolidge vetoed, stating, "Patriotism bought and paid for is not patriotism." The bill passed over his veto, stipulating payment in 1945. Then the Depression hit, and unemployment reached almost 25%. Veterans approached the government saying they wanted either their bonus or a job, and began referencing the 1945 payment date by calling it the tombstone bonus, meaning they'd all be dead if they didn't get some relief. Of course, the government had no money. To make their plight visible, approximately 25,000 veterans from across the country descended on Washington, D.C., some bringing wives and children, totaling another 1,100, and created a huge tent city, yet another Hooverville, this one figuratively in the president's lap. In order to put themselves in the best light, Walter Waters, the former sergeant operating as chief organizer and spokesman, instituted three rules: no panhandling, no liquor, no radical talk. Regardless, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI tried to tar them as communists. President Hoover referred to the protest as a temporary disease. The camps were tightly controlled by the veterans, who laid out streets, built sanitation facilities, and held daily parades. To live in the camps, veterans were required to register and to prove that they had been honorably discharged. 20% were disabled. And a Hearst columnist described the assemblage as, quote, down at the heel, all were slim and gaunt. There were empty sleeves and limping men with canes. The bonus army included Joe Angelo, who as a private received the Distinguished Service Cross for saving Patton's life on a battlefield in France. Newspapers across the country covered the story, but largely ignored one of its most novel elements. At a time when segregation was still the norm, bonus army blacks and whites were living, working, eating, and playing together. James Banks, the grandson of a slave, looked back on the camp as, quote, the first massive integrated effort that I could remember. Roy Wilkins, the civil rights activist, wrote about the camps for the NAACP Monthly, The Crisis, noting, there was one absentee, James Crow. Edward Everett Eastlick, a Democratic congressman from Tennessee, was speaking on behalf of the bill to expedite payment to the veterans when he died of a heart attack mid-speech. The vote was called 2 days later, and Waters was summoned and told privately it had failed. There was concern that violence would result when he informed the petitioners gathered outside. But a woman reporter whispered into Waters' ear, sing America, which the assembled marchers did, after which they dispersed, and many shortly left for home. However, some 20,000 remained, and Hoover, now concerned violence was inevitable, decided the encampment must be destroyed and the protesters disbanded. He authorized MacArthur to get it done, and the general sent Patton at the head of a cavalry charge by saber-wielding men on horseback, supported by tanks and infantry with fixed bayonets, as they routed the World War I veterans and their families with tear gas, a particularly odious action, given that many had been subjected to mustard gas during their service, and some still suffered the effects. Though Patton later referred to this as the most distasteful form of service, he directed the torching of the encampment. 55 were injured, 135 arrested, one woman miscarried, 12-week-old Bernard Myers died of complications of tear gas poisoning, and an 8-year-old was blinded as a result of being gassed. Eyewitnesses, including Eisenhower, said that the Secretary of War had made clear that the president forbade troops pursuing the bonus army beyond the bridge into the encampment, and that at least two high-ranking officers were dispatched to MacArthur to insist, but the general, as he did later in Korea, ignored the president's orders, refusing even to meet with his emissaries. When asked about it later on, Eisenhower said he had tried to dissuade MacArthur, quote, I told the dumb son of a bitch not to go down there. There was such universal support for the veterans. This is largely seen as the final nail in the coffin of Hoover's hopes at re-election. Shortly after the inauguration of President Roosevelt, bonus marchers began returning to the site. New First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt braved the mud and the rain and led marchers in a sing-along. Said one vet, Hoover sent the army, Roosevelt sent his wife. Following World War II, presumably having learned its lesson, the government created the GI Bill. How did you miss all that, General Kelly?
You know, I love your stories. You really intertwine military with very comprehensive stories that are humanistic. They're not just historically based. What's the takeaway?
Well, for me, I mean, it's certainly not about bashing America. The perfect country hasn't been invented yet. We don't have to be perfect. A thing that makes America different from other countries, many, is that we have lofty aspirations about who we want to be.
Right.
We don't always live up to it. Guess what? That's understood. But these are stories that should be told. We're not perfect. We don't have to be. How could we expect to be?
Right. And I think that's really a critical point. These are stories that have to be told. Too often, we tend to change the narrative, and that's not a good thing to do. We really have to be relentlessly honest, not reckless, but relentlessly honest about who we are. I also think that Johnny Carson is another icon kind of lost in the proverbial maturing of millennials. He was great. Look him up, everybody, too. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are enjoying my guest storyteller, Dan Carter, on So What's Your Story? Only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.9 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Consider all the great shows on KPFT, news, talk, culture, every musical genre. And although programmers here at 90.1 volunteer, you don't tune in and say, what a terrible show, but what do you expect from someone who just doesn't get paid? You expect excellence, and that's what we try to deliver all the time. The last thing that I want you to do is to tune in and hear. That's right, silence. We don't want you to do it, so call in your pledge to 713-526-5738. Or go online, stay in line. Even if you're out of line or in a lineup, for God's sakes, get to kpft.org/donations and scroll to So What's Your Story as one of those shows that you want to support. But whether you donate or not, this team will always be grateful for this city putting us on the map and on the air. Thank you. Let's talk about Houston as a center for storytelling. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The next swap is March 22nd, so visit their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link to that swap and all our story swaps, and for information about upcoming events like our famous Liars Contest held on April 30th. Also, every So What's Your Story show is on that site under radio program. So enjoy the best stories that I think you're ever going to hear and learn why this show has become a Houston institution. Please visit us on So What's Your Story at facebook.com/So What's Your Story. And let us know if you've got any guests that we ought to consider. That's how we find so many of them. Or text me, Hank, at 832-277-1581. You can also take your interest to storytelling at the next level by joining the Tejas Storytelling Association, who also has a festival coming up March 10th. Or you can also join the National Storytelling Network. There are all sorts of options, but my God, listen to stories and join organizations who will support you in that cause. The Moth, our friends of The Moth, is back at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month, where I think you're going to enjoy some of the best personal narratives you're ever going to want to listen to and meet some of the nicest people around. Dan, you've got a quick hitter that I like about your dad and your brother and Morse code, I believe. Tell us that story.
Sure. An ex-Navy signalman, my dad taught my brother and me Morse code and semaphore, and they became our private language. Randy and I would be playing baseball or football in the vacant lot down the block, and he'd come onto the porch and yell, "Yo!" to get our attention, and then play would stop, and he'd wave his arms to indicate a message was coming. My brother and I would know we needed to pick up milk or bread or a pack of cigarettes or how soon dinner was going to be ready. I don't think the other guys ever really got quite used to that. Dad would sometimes swear in Morse code. His favorite was 3 dots, 4 dots, 2 dots, dash. three dots is S, four dots is H. You get the picture. When I was not quite 12, for some reason, I was upstairs with the men's group for Sunday school. I really don't remember why. It was the first time, and I wasn't supposed to be there. It wasn't a regular thing. I was just a kid. But one of the men was really holding forth, and Dad, who was not physically affectionate, laid his hand against my thigh and tapped out with his first two fingers, "What a crock of three dots, four dots, two dots." And I spit a huge laugh, apparently for no good reason. And all the startled men looked at me. My father looked at me and then looked back at them as if to say, "It's a curse to have an idiot son." I was an Eagle Scout, but early on that path, there was an eventful overnight canoe trip that included a portage past the dam late on the second day. My best friend Rick, another guy, and I pretty much led the way on day one, but by the second day, we were bored and lagged way behind everyone else. Drifting lazily along, our 14-year-old minds kicked into adventure mode, and we said, "Hey, everything's lashed to the gunnels. Let's shoot the dam. We could get dunked, but so what?" The river started getting really wide by the time we caught up with the others, waiting impatiently on the shore. They started yelling and waving, but we were so far away we couldn't hear anything. We waved back and pointed toward the dam to indicate we knew what we were doing. Suddenly, my dad was at the water's edge, waving his arms. His message was terse: "Get over here." And we started paddling hard for shore. An important piece of information we'd somehow missed was that it was a hydroelectric dam. We would have been sluiced. There were several takeaways for me about that incident. The first was that my dad wasn't on that trip with us, so it was kind of amazing that he showed up at the right time. If he hadn't been there, I probably wouldn't be here. Second, our private language saved our lives. Third, all those other scouts and leaders with "be prepared" drilled into their heads had no tools ready at hand to save us from our juvenile stupidity. So, arcane knowledge can have practical applications, but it helps if it's shared with someone you can trust to be there for you and protect you from yourself.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. Morse code. Love it. What a great story. I wanted to stay with history and military for a moment. One of my favorite books is War Letters by Andrew Carroll. It's a compilation of letters written by soldiers from the Civil War to the Gulf War. And I want to read one typical letter written by a young soldier to his girlfriend moments before the Battle of Gettysburg. It reads, "Dearest Becky, I'm told the whole Reb Army is waiting up the road a ways, and this battle will probably decide the war. I don't know. Maybe I reckon most of us will die. And if I do fall, remember how much I love you so. Always have. Remember me, and I will remember you in my final breath. Yours, James." Now, this is a wonderful letter. It's a short letter. It's a romantic letter. It's a love letter, obviously. And the one thing that I want to point out is something very obvious. We don't write a whole lot of letters anymore. We don't even know what stationery and pens look like. That's one dilemma. But you know, it was July 1st, 1862. He's headed into Gettysburg. I am sure that he had more important things to think about other than this love letter. It's a young soldier who had perfect penmanship, correct grammar, and astonishing pride. He was killed less than 2 hours after it was written. My wife's great-great-grandmother collected beautiful letters written to her by Union soldiers asking her to court her after the war. I've seen them. Unbelievable. And they are much like the letter I just read. Now, millennials, don't throw stones at me, but collectively, you do not write well. Gettysburg isn't on your mind, so I don't know what your excuse is. But as someone once said, Santa has read your posts and is giving all of you dictionaries next Christmas. Now, in fairness, millennials do things better than most. They're positive, even when optimism can't be found. They express things in stories because they inherently can dig deep and take risks. A former student, Katie Galloway, is one of those who told such a story on this show. Magnificent, magnificent millennial, brilliant. It's a portrait of courage. And when we heard it, we were all in awe. Let me go ahead and play it for you.
And all my friends took me out to Chewy's Mexican food restaurant for the most delicious chicken fajitas. If you've never been there, shame on you. And we were so gorged. But of course, someone says, well, what are we having for dessert? Because no matter how much self-loathing is involved, you always have to have dessert. There's always space for that. So my best friend Greer says, oh, well, I have an idea, but you guys are just going to have to trust me on this one, which is always a bad idea. But we said, okay, we're 18. We're invincible. Let's do it. So we go down Westheimer, and all of a sudden she says, okay, hurry in here. It's House of Pies. And I turn in, and I was terrified. There was a homeless man on the sidewalk, and the building itself looked like it could just fall down at any moment when you open the door. And we thought, well, we'll trust her. So we walk in the front door, and I was hoping it would get better, and it just got worse. I felt like I had walked into a time warp. There were bacon and pancakes and fruit on the wallpaper, and the waitresses were dressed in these horrid maroon dresses with the hose and the grandma shoes and the smoker voices, and it just felt like I had stepped back in time to the 70s. And so I thought, oh God, I'm going to die of food poisoning on my 18th birthday. This is so bad. And she said, just trust me. So we sit down, and there's this paper menu, and it has dozens of pies on it. And I'm just thinking to myself, I am so indecisive, and I have no idea which one to choose. But then I thought, well, you can't mess up apple pie. So I get the apple pie, and it's warm, and the ice cream is on the side. And I think, okay, here goes. And I took a bite, and I knew in that moment that my life had changed, that this was special. And so the next weekend, I said, I have got to bring my brother, who was 16 at the time, Austin, and my little sister, Julie, who was 11, to House of Pies so that they could experience this with me. So I throw them in the car, and we get there, and they have pretty much the same exact response to it that I did. And they were terrified, and I said, just trust me, just trust me. So they fell in love with it just like I did on that very first night. And over that summer before I left for college, I tried to take them there a couple times a month at least, and just really build that bond with them and make sure that they knew that I was always going to be their big sister, even though I was moving away, and that they could always count on me. And also the people watching there is indescribable, but there's just nothing quite like being there at 1 o'clock in the morning and watching a cougar with mascara running down her face, trying to hit on some poor Joe Schmo over fried eggs, and the tweaker in the corner that you're not sure might shank you, and just bonding with all the servers that have such interesting life stories. And so we just really grew together. And when I would come home from school for Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever, that was the first place we went. I would pick up Austin and Julie, and we would go to House of Pies and catch up and just have a good time. And we always kind of had this unspoken rule that that was our special place. We never took our parents, which I think they would have put the kibosh on it if they had seen it. And we never took friends. It was just the three of us. And so when Austin came to me one day and said, hey, I'd really like to bring my girlfriend, Catherine. He didn't admit it, but I knew that must mean she was special. And so I said, okay, sure, why not? And over that night at House of Pies, I knew that she was so important to him and that she was perfect for my baby brother. And so from then on, she was kind of in the gang, and when she could, she would come. And so then about 2 years later, I was at school in Dallas, and I was raped. And I was in the hospital for a couple of days, and I thought I could hack it at school, but I was having panic attacks, and I couldn't leave my apartment. And so I knew that I had to move home. And I asked my parents, please don't tell Austin and Julie. I want to tell them myself. And at the time, they were 18 and 14, and I knew that they could handle the truth, but I needed it to come from me. And so I got home and I said, hey guys, we're going to House of Pies. And we got in the car and I didn't say anything about it until we got there. And when we sat down and we ordered our pie and I just told them everything and they were crying and I was crying and we got our pie for free. And we just, in that moment, I realized that House of Pies was no longer just a special place for us, that it was a safe place, that it felt like coming home, that it felt like going to grandma's house. It was just warm and special. And I moved home, and about 6 months after I moved home, my brother got very, very sick. He was born with cystic fibrosis. He was diagnosed with it as a baby. That's a lung disease that has no cure, and the prognosis is not good. And he was in the hospital for about 3 months. And while he was in the hospital, I would take him House of Pies, and I would spend the night at the hospital to give my stepmom a break to get home, but also just to have fun and hope that he could feel like he wasn't in the hospital. And the nurses hated when I went there because we were so loud and always up to no good. And then finally we got the phone call one day that he was going to get a set of lungs and they were going to be perfect for him. And so we got the surgery, went through it with flying colors, and about a week later they sent him home. And of course the first place we went was House of Pies. We packed up Catherine and I packed up Julie and Austin, and we all went to House of Pies, and he got his Bayou Goo, which is gross, but that's his favorite. And we just had so much fun, and that night was perfect. It was perfect. And 3 years later, almost to the day, my brother got very, very sick again. And unfortunately, with lung transplants in particular, the immunosuppressive drugs really make it difficult to stay healthy for very long. And so he was sick again he was in the hospital for about a month. And one Sunday he called me and he said, "Katie, I really want House of Pies, and can you just come hang out?" And you know, I was older by then and I had a full-time job. I was a restaurant manager working a million hours a week. And I just said, "Austin, you're going to have to get over yourself. Stop being such a baby. I have work in the morning." And I hung up with him. And the next morning I got a call saying that he had taken a turn for the worse overnight. My dad told me that he was now too sick to get a transplant. Which unfortunately is a very narrow line to walk. You have to be sick enough to need a new organ. But if you're too sick, they don't think you'll survive the surgery, and so they won't do it. And at that point, we knew that it was just a matter of time. And he was no longer lucid. They had amped up the pain medication so that he wasn't in pain. And so then on Thursday morning, my brother passed away. And the last thing I ever said to him was, "Stop being such a baby." And so that night I packed up Catherine and Julie and we went to House of Pies and we cried and we ate Bayou Goo, even though he was the only one that liked it. And we just remembered Austin. And I took one of those ugly 70s plastic paper menus and I took it home and I wrote a note to my baby brother and I said all of my hopes and dreams, and I tried to come up with a plan on how I would fill that void of him and our family. And I folded it up and I put it in his casket and I buried it with him. And 3 months after my brother passed away, I found out I was pregnant with the baby that I was told I couldn't have because of complications from the rape. And in that moment, I knew that this miracle was my brother's miracle, that this baby was my very own Austin. And now I look forward to the day when I can have a special place, my own House of Pies, with my very own little Austin.
Wow. What do you think, Dan, of that story?
Well, it's powerful. I mean, it's so personal. You know, they always say you get to the universal through the personal. And that story really illustrates that.
Yeah. Now, what does that mean, the universal? You mean it resonates with us all?
It resonates with everybody. You can't set out to write something universal.
Right.
You know, being universal is something that happens with, you know, with, like she did, just letting us into her world. Because mm-hmm. even though our stories are not the same as her story, it's a story that we can identify with. Yeah. Having something special, a special relationship, and all the details that that entails.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that story has so many trajectories. You know, everything yeah. from, my God, you know, I'm sitting in a house of pies, and I love it here, and I was raped at the University of Texas, and my brother was really ill, and later on, I had a baby, and I named him after my little brother Austin. The idea of putting those moments in time together and allowing them to thaw in one story, I think is astonishing. And I had mentioned a few minutes ago that I think that millennials do this best, and I'll tell you why. My experience base, I don't have any, and Dan, you might feel about this too, because you've taught for many years, but millennials seem to take risks easier. Like for example, when I was growing up, and I tell this story frequently on the air, I was raised by Holocaust survivors, right? And I have been depressed all of my life. I'm certainly not afraid to admit that. I mean, after all, it's not atypical. But when I was depressed as a kid, I couldn't talk about it because all I got were things like, oh, really? And when were you in a concentration camp? You know, getting depressed. And I'm the age of 5 years old, and I'm thinking, well, I wasn't in whatever you just said, but I guess I can't be depressed. So I'm kind of told inadvertently that I don't feel the way I do feel. And I can't feel the way that I do because I'm not supposed to. Does that make any sense?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In Katie's case, and in so many other cases, not just her, the idea of taking a risk and talking about the raw truth seems to be easier. I'm not sure why, but I think millennials do that very well. I think that we were raised in our generation, I think we were raised with more trepidation, a lot more reluctance.
Well, there were a lot of things that weren't supposed to be talked about when we were growing up.
Right.
You know, nobody wants to hear about your problems, you know, because they've all got problems of their own.
Right.
That's not true, but that's the way we were raised. I don't know why this jumped in my head. When I was a kid, these horrible cartoons from the 30s would play regularly. I don't know if you remember any of these.
Sure, I do.
They were nasty cartoons. And I would think, why would you let little kids watch? And one of them was, they were a lot often musical and they would sing songs. And one was the song was Mr. Nobody. And it was just, the only verse I remember of it was, who cares if your wife breaks a leg, Mr. Nobody. And I think, God, that was so nasty. And it played all the time, these ugly 30s cartoons.
Wow. Yeah. I don't know. You know, when I think about storytelling, I think about people as being an onion anyway, you know, metaphorically, and it's all rose peeling away things. But you know, storytellers have a way, millennials, I think, have a way of getting to the core very, very quickly. Maybe it's their incredible sense of honesty. You know, the word transparency is so typical in their vocabulary. I think it really applies to stories too, but I do know that some of the best stories that I've ever heard really are told by millennials, and for many, many good reasons, many good reasons. You know, Dan, this is sort of an anniversary for you because you were my guest on February 18th, 2021, just about a year ago. And you told stories about your father. They were wonderful. It was a PO. He was a POW of Japan in World War II. And I think that you said that that was the first time that you told those stories in public.
In public, yes. I've told them to friends over the years, of course. My friends had heard them.
Right.
And of course, my father was always telling them. And so it was his place to tell them as long as he was alive.
Right. But that was the first time you shared them on the air. And I remember how incredibly poignant that was. How did you feel about sharing them on the air as they were unfolding? I know I asked you that question during the show, but I want listeners to know how it feels to tell stories that you give yourself permission to tell. So how did it feel to share those stories on the air?
Well, it was a gift for me because it was the first time I ever told them in the first person, as if they were dead, you know, instead of saying, and then my dad did this, and then my dad did this. I slipped into him and told him the way he would tell them, at least for a couple of them. And so in a way, I was able to connect with him again. And my closest family, the people who were around who still knew him best, my sister, my brother, my niece, a couple of cousins, they were thrilled. They said it was like having Harold Carter back again, you know. So that was so it felt great in that way. It's probably the original reason we ever started telling stories.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. And I enjoyed that so much. And at what point, let me ask you another question. At what point in your life did you realize the power of your father's stories? Because I know that your father obviously was a tremendous catalyst, both in terms of having the stories that you wanted to tell and also encouraging you to tell stories. At what point did you know that the power of your father's stories are going to make a great impact on your life?
Boy, that's a tough one, because I don't think I'm ever aware of not knowing it. Really? And by that, I mean, he told those stories and, you know, they're atrocity stories, many of them, although he never wallowed in that part of it, as you know, from hearing me tell them. But some people would say, my God, we were telling those stories around kids, you know, but I was always aware that, I mean, on the one hand, there was my dad who was at home. And then there was this guy who was, whenever people were around, they were always drawn to him. He was very charismatic, and people gravitated to him. And if he didn't start telling the stories, they would prompt him, you know, but I would say that the thing I figured out fairly early on, before I had words for it, I was aware that the main thing about him was that he was always his authentic self. And there's an undeniable appeal that comes from that. My dad was a complicated man, like most people are. I would say he was universally respected, though not universally liked, although a lot of people did like him, and a lot of people were devoted to him. But he was a tough old cob. I mean, I say that, and people think of him as he was never physically abusive. I want to make sure that that's clear. But he was part of that hard scrabble generation. And but he was always his own unique, authentic self, and he had compelling stories, and he was great at telling them. So that was a large part of who he was in my life always.
Right. When you talk about authenticity is always an important ingredient for a storyteller. And, you know, you're an actor for many years and a storyteller. It's a hard question, but how would you conceptualize authenticity? If somebody asked you, how do you know if someone is authentic? What would you say?
Well, there.
It's tough, I know.
Lots of ways. I mean, the some people refer to that as your BS detector. Right. You know, when you're listening to somebody and you go, I don't think so. Uh-huh. I don't think that's the way that really went down. Right. But it's sometimes hard. You know, I would say we've all gotten, I don't know, when you can trust somebody and you say, even when you say, geez, that sounds kind of outrageous. Did that really happen that way? I'll have to take his word for it because I believe him. You know, you just believe. Sometimes you get taken in. I think it was one of those old movie moguls said the most important thing about acting is honesty. And once you learn to fake that, everything else is easy.
That's great. The power of story, man, the power of story. Yeah. Thank you, Dan Carter, for stories about shielding others from embarrassment in a way by caring for their dignity. Because I think that's a thread in your stories. It's about maintaining dignity. It really is. This is one of those common messages that seem to run effortlessly in your stories, and I wanted to thank you for also helping me during this fun drive. It's always a tough show to do because, you know, we got to kind of dip in and out, but boy, I really appreciate it. You're a professor, so while I'm setting up this closing tune, offer us a few words of wisdom to our millennials, okay? Can you do that?
Oh, well, let me see.
If you can't, I don't blame you.
I would say that somewhere along the road, I picked up the term knowledge for no good reason.
Okay.
Meaning, you know, it's the opposite of, is this going to be on the test? Some things it's just good to know. It's just fun to know. Right. And one of the nice things about being retired is my wife, who is a woman with two PhDs, she's never stopped learning, and I've tried not to. And one of the things we do in retirement now is we're sort of going through the catalog of the great courses. Every afternoon at 4 o'clock, we have a little iced coffee and we sit down and watch usually three episodes of whatever one we're watching, whether it's the Islamic Golden Age. Right now we're watching The Barbarians of the Steppes. We've watched a lot of U.S. history. We've watched religion and philosophy. It's like getting another undergraduate degree by watching television. These professors are fabulous professors.
Well, I have a perfect song to close. It's A Wonderful World, 1960, Sammy Cooke. And for those of you who never heard the song or him, well, I guess that's kind of my point now, isn't it? So let's go ahead and listen to this, and I think you're going to enjoy it. What a Wonderful World, Sammy Cooke. Don't you dare move, because Charles Hightower's R&B Gold is up next with a very cool mix of soul. Make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. Join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And I want you to keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end happily, it doesn't mean that we can't live happily ever after. Peace.
Well, I don't know what it was. I had a small quick thing that you know. How I could be that stupid. But I'm trying to be. Well, maybe I'll be a that stupid baby. I can take your love for me. Don't know much about this thing. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science. Don't know much about the French. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me,
what's happening, KPFTers? This is Jeff Plankenhorn. From my years of traveling the road with Texas artists, backing them up, to my rise to solo artist recording and touring all over this wonderful world of ours, I know just how important public radio is. And real DJs who have the freedom to play the music of independent artists like me and my friends, mentors, and musical cohorts, curated specifically for their listeners. KPFT is undoubtedly one of those very special stations. That's why I am hoping you'll support KPFT with your donation in any amount. Call 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. Help keep independent radio on the air and going strong on KPFT Houston.
Hello, Houston. This is your blue-eyed soul child, Bob Barovich, producer and host of the award-winning radio program Gospel Memories. For the past 20 years, Gospel Memories has brought listeners a steady stream of gospel, spiritual, and jubilee classics, as well as interviews with some of the great artists who recorded them. Now Gospel Memories can be heard in Houston on Sundays at 10 to 11 p.m. over KPFT 90.1 FM. The show features an hour of music from a collection of more than 25,000 recordings, covering some 8 decades of gospel music. Singers, duets, trios, quartets, groups, choirs, some nationally famous, others more regionally known, including artists from right here in Houston. So join us every Sunday at 10 p.m. for great gospel, spiritual, and jubilee music, the soundtrack of that old-time religion on KPFT 90.1 FM.
You're listening to